distance in your eyes. Oh no, I've said too much. I set it up. That's me in the corner.
Welcome back, and that's Losing My Religion by R.E.M. I missed it in 1991. The video for this song was banned in Ireland because its religious imagery was seen as unfit for broadcast. We're about to talk to Ali Abunima. His book before this was called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. He is a founder and director of the Electronic Intifada. He's an author of this latest book we're talking about, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And Ali, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
So this is an interesting day to have a conversation about this, given all that's been announced in the last few days about this, Palestinian unity that seems to have happened between, once again, between Hamas and Fatah, between the more establishment group on the West Bank that's been running the government, and Hamas had actually won the election and was pushed to Gaza. So what's your take on that in terms of what you've been writing about where the future is going?
Well, I think, you know, Palestinians yearn for national unity, but unfortunately I don't think this latest agreement is going to bring it about for a number of reasons. One is that the differences are very deep. They're really irreconcilable. On the one hand, you have Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, which is working closely with the Israeli army to continue to suppress any form of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation. And on the other, you have Hamas, which is committed to military resistance and to the right of Palestinians to resistance and self-defense, even though currently Hamas is observing a ceasefire that Israel negotiated with it last November. But I think the bigger picture is that, you know, even if they did achieve unity, Israel's control is so total that there's no ability for Palestinians to travel between the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Gaza remains under a really brutal siege, which I write about in the book based on my own visit to Gaza last year. And in the West Bank, Israel is continuing to gobble up Palestinian land. And so the Palestinian Authority, such as it exists, only really controls very tiny enclaves. So there's a danger that when we, you know, focus too much on Palestinian unity or disunity, we're distracting ourselves from the big picture, which is really Israel's more or less total control of the situation.
So a couple of things you said, I'm curious about. I was just reading a friend's analysis of it, and Bob Friedman, who we'll have on here as well, who is saying that Israel should have recognized and accepted the agreement between PA and Hamas. But that was the interesting arguments which we may talk about later. But if the gulf is also wide between those who support Hamas and those who have supported the PA or Fatah, and they're divided also because they're politically divided. They are divided on other issues of religion and the role of religion in society and many other things. So if that divide is deep and it represents the bulk of Palestinian people in terms of where the loyalties live, one side or the other, what does that say if that can't be bridged?
I honestly don't think the issues of religion are that deep. The vast majority of Palestinians are religiously observant, and Hamas is not, Hamas is a fairly mainstream group in Palestinian society in terms of religion. There are differences about the role of religion in society, yes, but I don't think those are so fundamental that they could be bridged. The real difficulty is over the role of whether to work with the occupation, as Mahmoud Abbas seems to think it's smart to do, or to stand up to it and resist it. That's really the fundamental difference. And in the battle for justice, injustice in Palestine, I actually go back through some of that history you mentioned, where after Hamas won the election, and it really did reach out. You know, it reached out in the same way that Sinn Féin reached out in Ireland and adopted the political strategy, which ultimately led to the successful peace agreement in Northern Ireland. And yet Hamas found the doors were slammed in its face. I mean, that's a big contrast to how the United States played its role in Ireland. In Ireland, the United States was instrumental in bringing Sinn Féin in and bringing the IRA in and cementing their political past, whereas the U.S. in Palestine actually backed a coup to try to overthrow Hamas after the election. And that's a major, major, major part of why we are where we are today. And that's a story that's very often left out of the news coverage. You know, people talk about this in a vacuum, that, you know, it's a Palestinian split, without pointing out that, unfortunately, in this case, as in so many others, the U.S. had a very dirty hand in what happened. But moving to this point where we are today, I think that a bigger question that not just Palestinians face, but really the United States, Israel, and everyone else, is that, you know, the whole paradigm of the so-called two-state solution has collapsed. Very few people believe that John Kerry's efforts will lead towards that outcome, or that this administration or any other are going to spend the political capital to bring it about. So they're asking, what next? And that's what I try to address in this book.
So let's talk about the what next. I mean, one of the things you clearly talk about this book, that this two-state solution will not work. And so the question is, then what does work? Let's talk a bit about what you're saying in here.
Yeah, I mean, just today, some pretty sensational comments by John Kerry were reported. You know, that over the weekend, in a closed-door meeting, he was recorded saying that, you know, without a two-state solution, Israel would become an apartheid state. Of course, many Palestinians and many others would say, well, they already live under apartheid. But the point is, for a U.S. Secretary of State to use words like that is very big. And what he's saying is, you know, unless there's a two-state solution very quickly. But he knows, and everyone else knows, is that that's not going to happen. And so I think it's a question of recognizing the reality that already exists, which is that there is already a single state. It's not, you know, can there be a one-state solution? It's recognizing that there already is a one-state solution. Israel is in control. Israel has worked for decades to erase any boundary between the territories it occupied in 1967 and other parts of the country. But, you know, the two populations live in conditions of radical inequality. And so the question is, can you end that inequality, and can people live as citizens in a common polity? The case I make in the book is that that is very pragmatic, possible, and realistic. And there are really important lessons we can learn from places like Northern Ireland and South Africa about how such a transformation can come about. And so in that sense, the battle for justice in Palestine is a very optimistic book, because I don't believe that there's no way out. I think there is a way out. But it does require people to challenge their thinking a little bit and to get beyond some of the slogans and cliches we're so used to repeating, and to actually think through these problems in a very logical way. And that's what I hope the book will help people to do.
Let's push that a bit further and talk more about what you've written here, because I think that this is... The reality and the contradiction here, I think, are really, really interesting. I can remember, a long time ago, 40 years ago. Is that right? About 40 years ago. There was this poster.
Yeah.
And this poster came out of Cuba. And the poster was of a map of the Holy Land. And on it had a Palestinian and Israeli flag. And then it had the slogan that said, three faiths, two people, one nation. And this was, I've kind of pondered this for a long time after seeing that poster and talking to people who actually believe that. And now I think what you're talking about is that we are at a place where the Israeli and Palestinian societies are so intertwined they couldn't untangle themselves, disengage from each other if they tried.
That's right. And moreover, if they tried, it would likely lead to even greater violence than we've already seen, as I explore in the book. To attempt to separate them, to attempt to create a homogenous Jewish state, as many Israelis demand, would likely lead not just to, violence, perhaps with some of the Israeli settlers, but it would probably lead at some point to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel. So it would not really end the conflict, as many people hope. It would really just put it into a new phase. And so I think that those dangers have really been overlooked, because we're so used to repeating these slogans about two states that are very, very soothing, but are really, really detached from the reality on the ground. And so in the book, I really try to tie practical solutions back to the reality and really say, well, this is the situation. Let's start from where we actually are and not start from where, our fantasies want us to be. And if you do that, and you actually ground this in the experiences in other places, you can actually come up with a very realistic and very hopeful and very just and ethical vision that is inclusive of everybody who lives there. And, that's ultimately where I think we have to go. People are tired of this. This conflict, this situation has destroyed the lives of millions of people, first and foremost Palestinians. I mentioned my visit to Gaza. People in Gaza right now are without electricity for 12 to 18 hours a day because of the siege. Palestinians in the southern part of Israel are facing expulsion from their land as Israel takes it over. Palestinians in the West Bank the same. This has to end. It's not necessary. Israelis don't need this in order to be able to live a safe and secure life. They can live a safe and secure life while Palestinians have their full rights. That's the case I'm making.
So how did you also make this connection between this idea and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement? Israel's response to it, you write a lot about in the book, but also there's a connection here for you between that movement and what you see coming.
Absolutely. I mean, the point is, the basic reality is that what has perpetuates and deepens the impasse is that there is such a vast power difference between Israeli Jews on the one hand and Palestinians on the other. And Israeli Jews have no incentive to seek change as long as they feel like, well, we can do what we like, and the United States keeps supplying us with weapons, the U.S. keeps vetoing resolutions, the European powers wring their hands but don't do anything. As long as Israel feels that it can do what it likes, then simple condemnations of, Israeli settlements and so on make no difference. And so the logic of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement is that, Israel, we should stop singling Israel out. Israel is the only country that has been allowed to carry out this kind of occupation, colonization for decades without any consequences. There's never been a single UN decision imposing sanctions on Israel. I mean, look at the contrast with Russia. Every day now, new sanctions are being imposed on Russia, a superpower. Nobody is immune to sanctions, except it seems Israel. So the BDS movement says, let's stop singling Israel out. Let's stop holding it to a lower standard that says just because Israel identifies itself as a Jewish state that it's not capable of applying the same human rights standards that demanded of everyone else. and let's hold it to that standard. And so it says that where governments have failed to act, civil society must step in. And that's exactly how the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa unrolled. And so Palestinians are saying, you know, the U.S. isn't doing anything, the UN isn't doing anything. We need civil society to act. That's the logic behind BDS. And it says basically that when Israelis feel enough pressure, then they will, like whites in South Africa, like whites in the South under Jim Crow, like other groups that have ruled over people without giving them their rights, they will feel a need to change. It's straightforward logic. There's nothing very complicated about it.
Now, one of the things I'll come into in a minute, but you also, pardon me, in the book have a chapter about and really write extensively about this connection you see between the issue of mass incarceration in America and Michelle Alexander's work and what happens here and what's happening inside Palestine with the Israelis.
Yes, I thought it was an incredibly important connection because on the one hand, you know, I'm saying, well, let's have a single state with equal rights for everyone. But, you know, in a sense, the United States is a warning that just saying that everyone is equal doesn't make it so. And the importance of Michelle Alexander's work and the new Jim Crow is showing how under, you know, an ostensibly colorblind system, we can still have really brutal systematic racism. And that's what produces mass incarceration, the wildly disproportionate imprisonment of African-American and Latino men in the United States is a symptom of that structural racism that has still gone unchallenged. And I saw real parallels there for what could happen in Palestine in the future if we're not attentive to the need to do more than just say everyone is equal, but to actually make it happen, do things that restore people to wholeness and restore communities to wholeness so they can actually function and fulfill all those rights. But there's another really important connection, which is that many of the companies that are profiting from mass incarceration in the United States, participating in it through running prisons and juvenile detention centers and so on, are also profiting from Israeli occupation. And in many cases, the technologies that the Israelis develop on Palestinians under occupation are then brought to the United States. And a really disturbing example of that is that just a few weeks ago, the Obama administration gave a contract to an Israeli arms company called Elbit Systems to provide surveillance systems along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, those surveillance systems were developed on Israel's illegal wall separating Palestinians from their own land in the West Bank. And that wall was declared illegal by the International Court of Justice in 2004. So this is an example of Israel's technologies developed through oppression and occupation now being brought to the United States. So those connections are very real. And campuses I visit, you meet many students who are involved in campaigns to get their universities to divest from prison, which I think is very, very important and a very significant effort to end mass incarceration in this country. So how much more powerful would those campaigns be if Palestine solidarity activists and Palestinian rights activists were working together with prison divestment and other activists? So there are real practical consequences as well to analyzing this situation in the light of what's happening in the U.S.
So I, you know, you talk a lot about and write a lot about what happened in both Northern Ireland and in South Africa. You write about this also, about the need of your concept of economic justice, which I want to get to. But when you look at those two places, especially South Africa, economic justice was not obtained, and people are still struggling for it. Then that's why the crisis exists. So the killing stopped on some levels. The violence was averted in terms of what bloodbath could have occurred that Mandela averted, and people argue back and forth whether it was good or not, whether it was the right decision or not. But what I'm saying is, so these examples are, so I'm curious how that fits into the scenario for the potential contradictions for a one-state solution. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, the critique which I make in the book of South Africa, and which others have made before me, is that political apartheid ended, but economic apartheid remained. And by many measures, there's more inequality in South Africa, and it is along racial lines than there was under apartheid. But absolutely nobody I've met makes the argument that that means that apartheid should not have been dismantled. Absolutely nobody says, and therefore, the apartheid regime should have been kept in place. So in other words, then, the problem is not that apartheid ended. The problem is that ending apartheid did not go far enough, and it left the basic economic structure unchanged. And so I think one of the lessons for Palestinians is that economic justice, economic democracy cannot be an afterthought. It needs to be an integral part of the struggle. And that is something that can actually create common ground with many Israelis, because remember, Israeli Jewish society is also very stratified along economic lines. There's a lot of poverty and very few rich families that control much of the economy in Israel. So that's one of the sad ironies I write about in the book, is that among Palestinians, there's a very small number of families who've gotten very rich in the past 20 years, working closely with Israel and getting along fine with the occupation, while the vast majority of Palestinians have gotten poorer, are suffering from mass unemployment. And that is mirrored in Israel, where there is also this vast concentration of wealth at the top and poverty for many, many other people. And for the poorest Israeli Jews, in the U.S. context, if I can jump to that for a second, there was this concept of the psychological wage that came from Jim Crow, that the very poorest white had nothing except their superiority over black. And for the poorest Israeli Jews, there's something similar, where it's really only their legally enshrined superiority to Palestinians that gives them any self-esteem. It would be so much better if we could come up with better grounds for solidarity than that.
And is this something that I think that many people wrestled with for a long time, and I'm just hearkening back to the late 40s when some prominent Israelis like Martin, Jews in Palestine like Martin Buber and Achal Ha'am, who is the great Hebrew poet, were arguing then for a binational state, that there shouldn't be just, that there can't just be one state for Jews and one for Arabs, because it won't survive. And I think that argument's always been under the surface, but for most, I would think, and I was thinking about this, as I was looking through your book, for most Jews in the world and most Israelis who also feel themselves to be, have a lineage of oppression and be an oppressed group, and we all know the history in the beginning of this, without the Holocaust, there probably would never have been in Israel. So the idea of losing a Jewish state, quote unquote, would be very difficult. How do you speak to that?
Well, I do speak to that in the book.
You do?
Very directly. There's a chapter called Israeli Jews and the One State Solution that looks at this notion that, Israeli Jews and perhaps other Jews are so attached to the idea of Israel as a Jewish state that they could never let go. And there I again make the comparison in South Africa and Northern Ireland. The people who controlled the state in those cases, whites in South Africa and Protestants in Northern Ireland, also thought that, their control of the state was a matter of survival, and letting go of it would be, you know, tantamount to national suicide, that they would be driven into the sea and slaughtered and so on. And yet they were capable of making that, that shift. And they also told themselves, our history is one of such oppression that we have no alternative to what we're doing. And yet they found alternatives. And in the book, I cite the South African scholar Stephen Friedman, who writes about the traditions within Judaism that allow people to make this kind of shift, that there is what he calls a usable tradition within Judaism that will allow a different narrative from the one that Zionism offers. And I think that's right. I think it would be at the height of bigotry to suggest that, you know, everybody else in the world, whether it's whites in South Africa or whites in the south of the U.S. or Protestants in Northern Ireland or whoever else, I think it would be bigotry to say that all of them are capable of changing the way they think and changing their relationship to people with less power, except for Israeli Jews. I'm entirely convinced that this kind of transformation is possible among Israeli Jews as well. And in fact, it's already happening. If we pay attention to some of the voices coming out of Israel, that they're very few, but they're very important, that there are Israeli Jews who are saying, you know, pretty much exactly the same kinds of things I am, and who are ready to embrace such a future rather than run in fear from it.
Well, Ali Abu Nima, this is, I mean, the book is amazing. I mean, there's so much in here. We could spend hours and hours. Maybe what we might have to do is come back to bring you back on with some others and really kind of pull out various segments of the book and just kind of wrestle with them. I think it deserves that. And I deeply appreciate the work you do in putting this book together. The book is The Battle for Justice in Palestine. We're talking to Ali Abu Nima, who is the founder and director of the Electronic Intifada and a journalist and a activist. His other book, of course, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Palestinian-Israeli Impasse. And once again, Ali, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Happy birthday, Leslie Gore, born on this day in 1946. That's her song, You Don't Own Me. You don't own me.